Thank you for the chairman and my dear brethren, sisters and young people. Well, over the next few days, God willing, we're going to look at the prophecy of Amos and to understand exactly what this little prophecy is about, and hopefully to receive some very powerful exhortations concerning life in today's society. If you come across to chapter 4 and verse 12, this is our theme for our studies. And really, I guess, it brings to a head the purpose of this prophecy. Chapter 4 and verse 12. Therefore, thus will I do unto thee, O Israel, and because I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. God attempted through the providence of his angels to change this people, and in the end they refused, and therefore all Amos could say was, it's time to meet thy God. And one day, brethren and sisters, we too will meet our God. And we will give account of our life in the truth before our Lord. But before we get there, God is ministering abundantly to us an entrance into his kingdom. And through his providence, he attempts to change us and shape us. And we, brethren and sisters, need to respond to that kind of care. We're going to find the prophecy of Amos a very terse and sharp prophecy. It's not like Isaiah's prophecy where there are lofty visions of the future. It is very down to earth. And Amos, in fact, is a different type of prophet that Israel had experienced. Some 50 years before, there were prophets like Elijah and Elisha. 30 years before, there were prophets like Jonah. These prophets were really considered to be patriots. But this man is altogether different. He doesn't belong in Israel. He comes from a different part of the country. And he is denouncing Israel in the clearest terms. It would have been a great shock for the people of Samaria to listen to the words of this man. When we come to Amos chapter 1 and verse 1, we find there's a play on his name in the very first verse. You see, Amos's name means burden bearer or burdensome. And the word there for words is the word burden. So you see that the Hebrew starts off, the burden of the burden bearer. The message was not a light prophecy. It was weighty, it was deep, it was a burden to bear and to give. And that's the way the prophecy is introduced. Now we're told in verse 1 that he was among the herdmen of Tekoa. The word herdman there, in fact, is a special Hebrew word that's used of a person who looks after a special type of sheep. In fact, the particular type of sheep was prized for its wool for the Middle East. So he wasn't just a herdman in the sense of looking after cattle, but also part of those herds were prized sheep. And that wool was exported through the capitals of Samaria and Jerusalem. Now he came from a place called Tekoa. Let's just picture where this place was, because it gives us an idea of the kind of environment from which he came. We can see that with the lights there. Here we have the Jerusalem here, and we have Bethlehem here, and we have Hebron there, and right about there is Tekoa. Now Tekoa was a garrison city, a desert fortress. And the reason why it was placed there was because it looks out across the wilderness of Judea, across the Dead Sea, into the hills of Moab. It had a commanding site and was there really as a garrison city, because the name of the town Tekoa means to blow the trumpet. It was there to warn Judah of impending invasion. There were desert raiders that came across the border at night. And it was the responsibility of the people of Tekoa to blow the trumpet, to warn people of these desert incursions. It was a very desolate and haggard world out there. Not like the place we've got here. As you stood upon the hilltop of Tekoa and you looked out towards the Dead Sea, so you're standing about here, and you're looking out across the Dead Sea to the great red walls of Moab here, it was a haggard world. And you stand there upon that spot, and you see these shelves of moorland dotted with vineyards. And then beyond there are broken rocks spotted with all sorts of undergrowth and bush. And then below that is this maze of rolling hills, which are absolutely burnt to a cinder in summer. And then beyond there is what's called Jeshimon. Jeshimon, the wilderness of Jeshimon, is the devastation of the land. Broken wadis, debris everywhere, a fierce and cruel world, right down to the Dead Sea. That's Amos's world. It was a vast, empty, silent, dangerous, and savage world. And that man kept his sheep in that environment. 1 hour, I guess, southwest brings you to the key road which led from Jerusalem to Hebron and finally down to Beersheba. That was an interesting road because we're going to see in our studies that it was the highway in which pilgrims came all the way from the north in Israel, crossing the border, and came down to Beersheba as pilgrims to shrines. It's almost like the Middle Ages, isn't it, in Europe. Beersheba was the place where God, of course, revealed himself to the patriarchs, and the Israelites had set up a shrine there. We're going to talk about those a little later on. The religion of the north was a very complex religion. We tend to think it was just idolatrous. It was much, much more subtle than that. Up in the north there, if we trace the road up from the north, we go up here from Tekoa, up here through Shiloh and Samaria, about a 3-day journey from where he was. These were the great markets where, in fact, Amos would have taken his wool and his produce. And there, brothers and sisters, the real life of the prophecy is about to unfold. We're going to see market life in Israel. We're going to see Phoenician peddlers. We're going to see slave traders who hunted the battlefields for bodies to sell. Aramean hostages, Philistine exporters, Israelite merchants, the embezzlers, the evil, the oppressors. All of this is in Amos' prophecy. It's a very real world. So far different from the stony silence of Tekoa. The very austere and aloof environment, disdained by the materialism of Samaria, was a great contrast, and the record is presenting that for us. Now, we know very little about Amos's character, but we do know a little bit about his occupation. If you come across to Amos chapter 7, we find this. He came in conflict with the church authorities in Samaria. Verse 14, then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son. So he had no background at all in prophetic activity. And when it says I was not a prophet's son, he didn't belong to the school of the prophets. He had no background at all in prophetic activity. Instead, he says, I was an herdman, a gatherer of sycamore fruit. A gatherer of sycamore fruit. Now, what's the sycamore tree? Well, the sycamore tree is a tree that only grows in certain parts of the land. In fact, it only grows in the warmer climates, down through here in the wilderness of Judea, also part of the Jordan Valley, and also part of the Sharon, which is this middle land here. It is susceptible to frost. It doesn't like cold. It's a tree which is a very, very poor and ragged tree. It grows about 10 metres in high with branches that go out laterally like that, easy to climb. It is a very poor quality type of fig. It's not very easy to digest. In fact, it was only bought and eaten by the poor as a very poor source of nutrition. In other words, if you had nothing else to eat, you could go out in the desert, climb the sycamore trees, and eat this unsweetened fig if you had no money. This man got those and sold them in the market. So you can imagine that the price of selling those things was not very great. Amos was not a wealthy man. Now, the interesting thing about that verse is that the word gatherer in the Hebrew means a piercer. He was not so much a gatherer of sycamore fruit, but a piercer of sycamore fruit. Now, what does that mean? Well, you see, the fig itself is a very small berry, about that size. And it was the job of these men to make it more palatable, was to actually go to every single tree and puncture the fruit, pierce the fruit. And what that did was, in fact, liberate ethylene gas. And ethylene is a well-known fruit ripener. And if you catch the fruit at the right season, it grows 10 times larger after you've pierced it. You've got to do it at a certain time because the wasps come in and infect the fruit. And you've got to get it before the wasp comes. And you've got to pierce every single piece of fruit. How would you like that for a job? Going out in the desert regions and finding the scattered sycamore trees throughout the desert, climbing the trees with a sharp knife, piercing every single piece of fruit. Next tree, doing exactly the same. The next tree, wandering all through that savage world, piercing fruit that you might produce fruit in that tree. And that, brothers and sisters, was exactly what his job was in his prophecy. To pierce the skin of Israel. To go up there in the north and to take the word of God and to put it sharply through their hearts. And the issues he's going to raise are very, very significant issues. And as the cut of the word went into those people, his whole job, brothers and sisters, was to produce fruit in them. How would you like that job? And do you know that the main crop occurs six times a year? So every couple of months, he's into the desert, piercing fruit, then going back 3 days later and picking them. That's his job, his task, to produce fruit. Now, what's the symbol, what's the significance of the sycamore tree? Let's come to Luke chapter 19. I'm sure we know the story of Zacchaeus. But it's interesting because the story of Zacchaeus really is the story of Amos. Luke chapter 9, down in Jericho. So we're not very far from Tekoa, are we? We're in the same region of the prophet. In verse 2, there's a man named Zacchaeus, who was chief among the publicans, and he was rich. In verse 3 of Luke 19, he sought to see Jesus, who he was, and could not for the press, because he was little of stature. And verse 4 of Luke 19, he ran before and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was to pass that way. So here we are, the sycamore tree. Now we've got a rich man, a very rich man, in a poor tree. The sycamore, as I mentioned before, is the wild fig tree, which the poor were used to. So here's a bit of an anomaly, isn't it? A rich man sitting in a poor tree. It was the job of the publicans to tax the people. In fact, the taxation system was a very, very touchy subject in Israel. These people were contractors to Rome. Rome didn't care how much they charged in the contract, providing they got the taxation from the people. So, of course, the publicans added on their cut. It was an exorbitant cut. So here's a man who's used to plundering people. Or should I say, he belonged to a class of people who plundered the poor. Very much like the people in Israel in Amos' day. But this man is a bit different, you see. He's in the sycamore tree, next to the fruit in the sycamore tree. What kind of man is he? Verse 8. Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. If I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." Now that is an amazing man. He wasn't out to oppress the poor, he was out to help the poor. Now, you think about this man. The half of my goods I give to the poor. Could you give 50% of your income into the ecclesial collection? 50% of your income into the ecclesial collection. And if in your job of taxing people, you accidentally charged more than you're supposed to take, could you give that back with a 400% gift to the person that you accidentally took the money from? That's an amazing man. An amazing man. And this rich man in that poor tree, in helping the poor, in supporting the poor, really, I think, encapsulates the prophecy of Amos, the sycamore tree man. Because his job was to go into Israel and to defend the poor. The righteous who were being afflicted in Israel needed assistance. And this man was exactly that. So the sycamore tree, brothers and sisters, represents the ability of God to produce fruit in the worst environments. You could never think of a worse job in Israel than the publican's job, despised by everybody, everybody. And yet that man gave half his income to feed the poor. That's exactly what Amos is about to do. So let's come back to Amos chapter 1. Here he is in verse 1. Among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Now, the first thing we notice is that he prophesies in Israel. So he lives here in Tekoa, but he prophesies in Samaria, in Israel. He crosses the border into hostile territory up there in the north. Now, why should God raise a man from Judah and place him in the north? I mean, surely there were prophets in the north. Well, you see, there were prophets in the north. When we come across to chapter 2 and verse 12, this is what we find. But ye gave the Nazarites wine to drink, and commanded the prophets, saying, prophesy not. There was a deliberate campaign in the north of Israel to muzzle and silence every single prophet that came from that region. So Israel thought they were being smart, you see. We can silence the prophets. We can refuse to have them in our country. So God took a man from Judah, outside the boundaries of their jurisdiction. And brothers and sisters, he brought a man. He brought a man from the harshness, from the great desert country of Judah, and placed him right into the opulence of the north. Let me just give you the background to Israel. The last 50 years to be summarized in a verse. Let's come to 2 Kings chapter 10. The last 50 years, just before Amos arrived on the scene, can be described in one verse. And it just summarizes everything about what was happening there in the north. 2 Kings chapter 10. Verse 32. In those days, Yahweh began to cut Israel short, and Hazael smote them in all the coasts of Israel, from Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites, the Reubenites, the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, even Gilead and Bashan. God began to cut Israel short. And what that means is that they came around the Golan Heights area and began to chop off all of those towns around Galilee. For 50 years, Israel were being cut short, decimated by invasion. In the south of the country, things were completely different. We have here this king called Uzziah. His reign was marked by expansion and prosperity. So immediately we have this discrepancy and disparity in Israel. The south, very prosperous. The north being decimated piece by piece by Syrian invasions. But then, brothers and sisters, there was a tremendous change around in the fortunes of the north. Come to 2 Kings 14. In 2 Kings 14, we really have God's change of direction. 2 Kings 14, verse 25. He, that's Jeroboam, restored the coast of Israel. From the entering of Hamath, which is right up the north in Lebanon, unto the Sea of the Plain, according to the word of Yahweh Elohim of Israel, which he spake by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, which was of Gath-Hepher. For Yahweh saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And Yahweh said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. He had mercy upon Israel. Think about that. This is the ecclesia in the north. Idolatrous. There were a few scattered righteous brethren and sisters around the place, which we will see in a moment. The place was being decimated by invasion. And when Yahweh saw the affliction of that place, which was very bitter, he raised up a deliverer. And the deliverer was King Jeroboam II. Here he is, Jeroboam II. He was an idolater. But God raised him up to take the pressure off the north, to allow them to understand that God was working with that group to try and change them. Now this produced great affluence. I mean, suddenly there's an expansion of the country. No longer were they being slaughtered left, right, and center. Expansion moved all of the influence up to Lebanon. Never before had that happened. And we find, brothers and sisters, that a generation was bred that had never witnessed war or hardship. This is the generation to which Amos is prophesying. We find a dramatic expansion of city and town life. No longer were there rude houses and small villages. There's expansion in building everywhere. We find there's a growth of wealth and comfort and ease. But of course, along with that came the exploitation of the poor, including brethren and sisters. We find that there was a closer integration with other nations. They were now prosperous and trading, and international trade went across the border. But also there's an explosion of injustice and fraud. So what's God going to do? He's raised up a deliverer. Borders have been expanded, the wealth is pouring in, everyone's got a bit of money now, everyone is expanding and prosperous. Yes, they'll exploit the poor to get wealthy. They're causing justice to happen. What is God going to do? Well, Amos went up there in the north with a message. But in addition to that, brothers and sisters, we're going to see that God increased a number of physical calamities in the north there, deliberately targeted on specific areas of the land to try and wake this people up. We're going to see that he sent rain on one village, not on another. We're going to see that he shook the land in one part and not another. We're going to see God deliberately manipulating the geographic features of the land to change these people. And Amos came in to tell them exactly what God was doing, why he was doing it, why there was rain on one and not on another. Otherwise Israel would have understood. I mean, they just would have thought, well, it's raining today over here, but not over here. But Amos went into that area to tell them exactly what God was doing. So we're going to see that there's an increase in physical calamities. And also, Assyria was kept at bay. The huge Assyrian power looming on the horizon, ready to strike. That's the background to the prophecy of Amos. An intriguing background, brothers and sisters, because that's the world in which Amos went into. Do you know what the subjects of his prophecy were? These are the crimes that Amos spoke out against. Cruelty, selling people into slavery, treachery, mercilessness, barbarity, burning hatred, despising the law, selling the innocent, immorality, idolatry, corruption of the Nazarites, silencing the prophets, and we've only reached the end of chapter 2. Tumult and oppression, violence and robbery, false worship, oppression and cruelty, injustice, absence of righteousness, hating of the righteous, bribery, ease and luxury, and deceitful business practices. That is an enormous list. And you know, brothers and sisters, that is really our society, isn't it? That is exactly our society. And Amos is going to give us God's perspective on how he sees those kind of practices. And I can tell you that Amos is absolutely clear about how God sees all of that. Let's come back to Amos chapter 1. The setting of the prophecy is also given for us at the end of verse 1. It was 2 years before the earthquake. Amos chapter 1 and verse 1. 2 years before the earthquake. Now, what is this earthquake? We don't know very much about this earthquake, but it was the earthquake that shook the world in the days of Uzziah. In fact, it had a highly significant impact on Jewish society. If you come to Zechariah 14, many, many, many years later, hundreds of years later, it was still remembered by people. Even when they came back from captivity, it was still remembered. In Zechariah chapter 14, the greatest earthquake the world will ever experience when Christ returns is when the Lord Jesus Christ stands upon the Mount of Olives. Now look at verse 5 of Zechariah 14. And ye shall flee, it's not to, but it should be the word from, ye shall flee from the valley of the mountains. For the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azel. Yea, ye shall flee, like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah king of Judah. That's the same earthquake mentioned in Amos chapter 1, verse 1. Now think of this. It was still remembered hundreds of years later as to what happened when the earthquake shook the land in the days of Uzziah. And of all the earthquakes in which Christ's earthquake is likened to, is the one which occurred in the days of Uzziah. So when we come back to Amos chapter 1, we can see, brothers and sisters, that hanging over the prophecy of Amos is this threatening judgment. When Amos prophesied, the earthquake had not yet afflicted the land. It was coming. It had been predicted. It was coming. And Amos' prophecy is couched 2 years before it happened. Because all of the judgments, or should I say, sorry, most of the judgments in the prophecy of Amos are going to be, in fact, executed before this particular earthquake. We're going to see a number of allusions to this judgment throughout the prophecy of Amos. Verse 2, Yahweh will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. That's quoted in Joel chapter 3, verse 16, about the future earthquake at Armageddon. It was, brothers and sisters, to be a devastating earthquake. He will utter his voice. I don't know if you've ever heard an earthquake. It's like a clap of thunder before the ground begins to rumble. And the clap of thunder, of course, is likened to the voice of God. It's exactly what Amos is saying. Yahweh will utter his voice from Jerusalem. Jerusalem will be the epicenter of this earthquake. From chapter 1, verse 3 to chapter 2, verse 16. We have outlined judgments on six Gentile countries, followed by judgments on Judah and Israel. And you may have noticed, as Brother Emmanuel read that this morning, that these particular judgments all have this expression, for three transgressions and for four. If you want a good little Bible marking exercise, it's a good idea just to highlight all those verses. They really stand out, those prophecies. And all of them, except the last one, are all finishing with this expression, I will send a fire on the wall which shall devour the palaces. So that's the way the prophecies are in fact interpreted. For three transgressions and for four. What does that mean? Well, it's a Hebraism, that is a colloquial expression in Hebrew. For three transgressions and for four simply means this, that for three clear, distinct points and an extra one for emphasis, I'm going to judge you. I've got very clear accusations. And I've got one more, just in case you're worried. That's the way the Hebrew is couched. Most nations receive one accusation. Judah receives three, and Israel gets eight. Deliberate accusations against these people. For three transgressions and for four. It's very clear, says God, and I've got some extra too. I'm going to judge the people. The main judgment, in fact, was this sending of the fire upon the wall. And this is the language of judgment by earthquake. In other words, brethren and sisters, these judgments that were read this morning for the various countries, Amos was warning these people that judgment is coming and the earthquake is going to absolutely destroy everything in those countries. That's what he was saying, in a nutshell. How devastating was the earthquake? Look at verse 2 again. Yahweh will roar out of Zion, utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the habitations of the shepherds shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. I'll just put this map back here. I just want to show you exactly what's occurring here. The safest place in an earthquake is when you're in the open fields. And that word habitations there is the Hebrew word pastures. The safest place in an earthquake is out in the open pastures. There's no trees for you to fall on. There's no buildings to collapse on top of you. You're reasonably safe. But so devastating was this earthquake that it would in fact affect the habitation of the shepherds. So all the pastoral country through here and through here will be devastated. Furthermore, the top of Carmel shall wither. Now Carmel is up here in the north. It was the most fruitful part of the land. The word wither means to be burnt with fire. Now earthquakes don't normally cause fire. But they would in this case. I don't know whether we have bushfires in this country, but we do in Australia. And lightning strikes, storm, and seismic activity does produce fire, bushfires. The same would happen here, which would race through the land and affect even the most fertile. But can you think of a reason why perhaps Mount Carmel should be identified? Because you see, it was at Mount Carmel that Elijah the prophet contended with the prophets of Baal. Elijah won. The prophets of Baal were destroyed. But you see, now the prophets of Baal are back. And therefore God would target that region right up in the north to make sure that he made Israel understand that he had not forgotten the contest. And the God who caused fire to come from heaven was now the same God to send fire through there as a result of the earthquake. So you see, brothers and sisters, it was going to be a huge devastation. Absolutely huge. When we look at the map here, we see, in fact, that each of the surrounding countries were going to be devastated. The first here was Damascus, just slightly off the map up here. Right there in the north, Damascus. Why Damascus? Verse 3. Because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. Do you know what that means? Gilead is the region here, just around Sea of Galilee, down to Tishbe, around here. Golan Heights, down on the eastern side of Jordan. That was the area, remember, when Ben-Hadad and Hazael came in and they cut Israel short. Do you know what they did? The survivors of that, they laid along the ground and they took threshing instruments of iron, which were like a wooden platform studded with iron bolts, which they used to run across the grain to get rid of the husks and to leave the grains behind. And they laid all the people on the ground and they got the horses hitched up with these threshing instruments and rode over them. And for that, says God, I will set a fire which will devour the palaces. You know, we talk about barbarity today. That's the Syrians. Then there was the region of, in verse 6, Gaza, the Philistines. Here we are, Philistines through here. They'd encroached up here in the north. What was their crime? Halfway through verse 6, they carried away the captive, the whole captivity, to deliver them to Edom. So there were incursions from the west, and those that they captured, they sold into slavery. And the people they sold them to were the Edomites here. We're going to see the Edomites in a moment. They absolutely hated anything that was Jewish. We're going to see the attitude of Edom in this chapter in a moment. So you imagine there's a war going on and you get the captives, you get all these people, so you sell them off to your worst enemy. They're also going to be judged. You've got Tyre in verse 9, halfway through, because they delivered up the whole captivity of Edom. And the typical Phoenicians are the middlemen. So what happened was, up here in Phoenicia, you had the Philistines who made incursion into Israel. They got the captives, they took them all the way up to Tyre and Phoenicia. Phoenicia bought them and sold them at a profit to the Edomites down here. Imagine being taken all the way up there, sold into slavery, then sold again at a profit. You're just chattel, you're just goods. You're just the means by which profit can be made. How do you like that? Under the law of Moses, dealing in slaves attracted the death penalty. Because selling people into slavery was not only dehumanizing, you virtually destroyed a person's life. No mercy at all from those two countries. And what about Edom, verse 11? Because he did pursue his brother, and his brother, of course, is Judah and Israel, with the sword, and did cast off all pity, and his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. In other words, this country down here, Edom, though they were brothers, Esau and Jacob, that didn't mean a thing to the Edomites. They had continual, perpetual hatred, anger, and wrath against their brethren. What does God think of that? Not just a disagreement. Perpetual hatred and wrath. He would destroy them as well. And this was the crowd that received the captives via Philistia and Tyre. God says, I'll sort those people out as well. The Ammonites. Here are the Ammonites here. They also invaded Gilead through here. So you've got the Syrians from the north, the Ammonites from the south. And those Israelites in Gilead, well, they were the sandwich in the meat in the sandwich, weren't they? Squashed between those powers. You want to know how the Ammonites waged war? Halfway through verse 13. They ripped up the women with child that they might enlarge their border. We need some land. We need to expand our territory. Let's go raiding. There are some women here expecting children. No mercy. The knife through the woman. The fetus destroyed along with the mother. That's the kind of barbarity of the Ammonites. God says, I will sort you out too. You know, that's the world of Amos. That's the world of Israel and Judah. Cruel people around those borders. And they came in. And they made incursions, and they took captives, and they burnt villages, and they destroyed people. That's the world in which Amos lived. Do you know, brothers and sisters, an awful society of which God was soon to tackle. In chapter 2, verse 1, we come down to Moab. Now, Moab's here in the middle, between Ammon and Edom. Well, Moab, what kind of person was Moab? Well, he didn't really become judged for anything he did to Judah and Israel, but rather he was judged for this kind of attitude. Halfway through verse 1, he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. So you see, Moab's here, and here is Edom down here. So these two are fighting each other. And so fierce is the hatred that when the king of Edom dies, these people make a cross-border raid dig up his bones, burn them to lime, and go back across the border. I mean, what makes people do that? The sheer fierceness of that hatred. To dig up someone's bones and burn them. It's a little bit like, isn't it, the papacy who burned the bones of, I think it was Tyndale, remember that? And threw his ashes across the River Severn, that no one would ever know where he was buried. It's that kind of intense hatred in people. God says, I'll sort them out too. Now, why do you think, brothers and sisters, that Amos should begin his prophecy against the nations? Well, I think it's a very, very interesting psychological approach, I guess you could say. Very interesting. You see, here you are, you're brand new into Israel. You come from the south, you don't really belong. You come in your rough garments because you're a poor man used to piercing sycamore fruit and looking after sheep in the desert. And you walk into the opulence of Samaria, to the hustling, bustling marketplace. And there you stand in the market square, and immediately people's attention are upon you. You sound different because your accent is from Judah. And there in the marketplace, brothers and sisters, you stand, thus saith Yahweh, and immediately people begin to listen to that. Who is this man? I thought we got rid of all the prophets. I thought it was the policy of the king to silence men like this. What's he doing there? Then he starts off. Thus saith Yahweh, for three transgressions and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof from Damascus. You can hear the cheers. Damascus, yes. Of the Philistines, yes, the Philistines. Tyre, yes, the Tyrians. Edom, yes. Moab, yes. Ammon, yes. Judah, yes. And then he turns his attention to Israel. And he outlines, brothers and sisters, eight crimes. And now you see, having established his popularity and having denounced everybody else and got everyone's attention riveted to him, he now starts on them. Very, very clever, isn't it? He's got the crowd now, and now he starts his attention on Israel. Eight crimes. Eight specific crimes. And the significant thing is that the prophecy does not finish with the words, I will send a fire upon Israel. He would do it with the other countries, but not yet Israel, because the rest of the prophecy is really a prophecy attempting to turn the nation back before the judgment comes. The fire will come, but that comes in later chapters. This is what he denounces. These people sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. They pant after dust of the earth on the head of the poor. They turn aside the way of the meek. A man and his father go into the same maid to profane God's name. They lay themselves down upon clothes laid a pledge by every altar. They drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. They give the Nazarites wine. They command the prophets, saying, prophesy not. Eight particular sins. We're just going to look at a couple this morning, just to see what Amos is actually going to do. Let's look at verse 6. You've sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. Now, what does that mean? Firstly, it tells us that there were righteous brethren and sisters in the north. Imagine living in that country. There was a small ecclesia or ecclesias up there in the north being crushed by this expansion of prosperity. And we're going to find out that Amos in fact talks to this group later on in the prophecy. He makes a connection with them. And he gives them advice how to survive Israelite society. But here they are. They're sold for silver. Now, what does that mean? Remember the story in 2 Kings chapter 4, when there was a widow whose husband used to be one of the sons of the prophets, and she had no money. And the creditor was knocking at the door, asking for money. That's Israelite society. If you can't pay your debts, if you can't afford to live, the creditors are And also they were selling the poor for a pair of shoes. In this case, the poor debtor could not even afford a pair of shoes, the merest trifle. The merest trifle. And when he was hauled before the courts, he was sold because he couldn't afford to buy a pair of shoes. You know, Amos understood those people. He himself had come from a very poor background, and he felt empathy with those people. You know, it's telling brothers and sisters that here's a society with absolutely no compassion whatsoever. None whatsoever. No compassion. What should be our attitude towards the poor? Go to Proverbs chapter 14. The poor in Israel, the poor in the ecclesia. Proverbs 14. Verse 31. He that oppresseth the poor reproacheth his maker. Now look at that. If you oppress the poor, you are reproaching the God who made him. But he that honoureth God hath mercy on the poor. So you see, you honour God by having compassion on those amongst us who, brothers and sisters, are having difficulties. You don't take advantage of them. You certainly don't oppress them. And you honour God by having mercy upon them. There's a compassion there. Now, I know in South Africa, where there's a situation where you have lots of people in a society that's not very wealthy, sometimes we can harden our hearts, can't we, towards each other. But you see, brothers and sisters, mercy to each other, compassion to each other, is something which knows no law. There is no law saying that we have to show mercy. But it is a quality of God to do so. If we take advantage of each other, then we are really falling into exactly the same category as these people in Amos's day, who had no compunction about getting rid of people and taking advantage of them. Let's come back to Amos chapter 2 and verse 8. They lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar, and they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. Now what is this? They lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge. Now in Jewish society, and under Jewish law, if you made a loan to a brother and sister, you in fact were permitted to take some security for the loan. Today, I suppose, you buy a house, the house becomes security for the mortgage, or the bond, I think you call it here. Well, it's exactly the same here. You make a loan, you can actually ask for some security. Now, you think about this. The law didn't say you had to take security, but the law allowed you to take security if you felt that your money was at risk. If you loaned some money to somebody, you could, in fact, ask for the clothes as security. Now, think about how hard-hearted you would need to be to take someone's clothes as security. I mean, what value, if you had to sell those clothes to get the money back, what value would you get in a second-hand shop for clothes? And these people, when they lent the money out, took the clothes. I mean, that's how hard-hearted they were. Valueless things, but they took the clothes. Now look what the law said. Come back to Exodus 22. Just to show you the evil of these people. Exodus 22. Verse 25. If thou lend money, Exodus 22 verse 25, to any of my people that is poor by thee, thou shalt not be to him as a usurer, neither shalt thou lay upon him usury. So you are not permitted to charge interest on any loans to your brother. Verse 26. If thou at all, you see, it wasn't saying you had to, but if you were hard-hearted enough to do this, if thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge or as security, thou shalt deliver it unto him by that the sun goeth down. You were not permitted to hold that security overnight. I mean, if he was poor enough that all he had for security was his clothes, then you've got to get it back to him by nighttime. Verse 27, for that is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin. Wherein should he sleep? I mean, see what the law is doing? I mean, how possibly could you take this? This is like his skin. It's like taking his skin off him. It's what he sleeps in. That's all he's got to change, his own clothes. Now, if you are hard-hearted enough to take that as security, make sure you get it back to him by nightfall. Verse 27, it shall come to pass, when he crieth unto me, that I will hear, for I am gracious. You may not be, but I am. Now, when we come back to Amos, look what they were doing. Amos chapter 2. In verse 8, they lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar. Do you know what they were doing? They were taking the clothes as security. Instead of returning that by night time, they held on to it. They went down the road to the local shrine, and they laid that garment down in front of their idolatrous altar and slept in the garment that night. Can you see the evil of that? Not only did they deliberately bend the law, in absolute sacrilege of everything God stood for, they laid this piece of garment in front of an idolatrous altar, and there they worshipped and slept that night in that garment. Not only do they lack compassion, not only do they lack mercy, they were deliberately throwing the law back into God's face. God says, if that man cries, I will hear, because I am gracious. And he was hearing, he was listening. That's the kind of society it was in Israel. And the rest of verse 8 says, they drink the wine of the condemned. Rotherham says, exacted wine in the house of their God. What's this exacted wine? Well, you see, when people were falsely condemned, they were fined. And the fine, of course, took either produce or silver. If you didn't have any money, you had to give produce. So here were the rulers who were taking these people to court because they couldn't pay their debts. The clothes had been ripped off them anyway. And they were then forced to pay fines, exacted wine, says Rotherham. So they grabbed the wine, they walked across the house of their God, and in front of their idols, they poured out the wine and drank it, whilst the poor man was destroyed. Yeah, brothers and sisters, that is an unbelievable attitude. Unbelievable attitude in Israel. Heartlessness. Absolutely stone-hearted, no sense of compassion at all. That was condemned by God. Verse 12 is our final point for this morning. Let's read verse 11 for connection. I raised up of you sons for prophets. That's the school of the prophets. Remember Elisha building the schools of the prophets? God said, that was my work. I raised them up, and of your young men for Nazarites. Now, what were Nazarites? Well, Nazarites were a special class of people in Israel that were encouraged to commit themselves to God. You see, if you were a young man from Judah or from Benjamin or from Ephraim, and you really wanted to commit your life to God, you really were disadvantaged because you were not of the tribe of Levi. Only the Levites, in fact, that could really perform any of those functions for God. So God introduced a law, the Nazarite law, which allowed you from any other tribe, man or woman, to commit your way to God completely. It was an opportunity to come close to God. In fact, the provision of the law allowed you to almost become like a little high priest. Not that you could function through the offerings of sacrifices, but God viewed your status, your voluntary contribution to the work, as almost like a high priest. That's how God viewed that. Now, of course, what happened was that when the north was fractured from the south, Jeroboam the First put anybody in the priesthood. Anybody you like. Doesn't matter where you came from. In fact, your only qualification was that you had to be an evil man, because the record says he took the basest of men. So if you were an out-and-out rotter, you were ideal for the priesthood in the north. A little bit like today, isn't it? Today's priesthood. The Nazarites, however, were still a small class in the north, in this environment, who committed themselves to God. These are the people that Elijah and Elisha were trying to encourage. Now, under the law, it was forbidden for these men to drink. No wine at all. Do you know what the Israelites did? Verse 12. Ye gave the Nazarites wine to drink. They deliberately put a stumbling block in the path of these people and deliberately encouraged them to drink and to break their vow. Now, it's one thing, brothers and sisters, it's one thing not to have compassion on others. It's another thing to go out of your way and deliberately undermine the attempt of honest and genuine people to destroy their faith in God. That's a different thing altogether. To discredit honest people, to deliberately corrupt their conscience, that is something altogether different. In Matthew chapter 18, the Lord spoke about that kind of behavior. Matthew 18. People who go out of their way to destroy others in the truth. It is one of the most evil things to be involved in. Now, Matthew chapter 18, we have this remarkable discourse concerning relationships with each other. It's remarkable because, you see, in verse 17, Jesus introduced the word ecclesia. And that's interesting because there was no ecclesia. So really, you see, this chapter deals with issues that he raised with the disciples because he knew that this group of people would become the nucleus of the ecclesia after his death. And what was happening, brothers and sisters, was that they were disputing, they were arguing amongst themselves. There's almost a strife in the group. Jesus had just said that I'm on my way to Jerusalem, I will be crucified, I'll be put to death at the hands of wicked men. And whilst he's talking about crucifixion and sacrifice, there are 12 men back there arguing about who is the greatest before God. So the Lord stopped the procession. He turned around and stopped them in their tracks. In verse 2, Jesus called a little child unto him and set him in the midst of them. You imagine that, these 12 grown men, and the Lord takes a young child, clearly there's a larger group with them, and they stop the whole procession. And a circle of grown men with the Lord and this child in the middle. And the Lord said in verse 3, let me tell you this. Verily I say to you, except ye be converted and become as little children, you won't even enter the kingdom of heaven. See, they were debating as to who was the best, the most deserved, the most honorable, the greatest. The Lord says, look, unless you change, you won't even get into the kingdom of heaven. And from that point onwards, he talks about relationships in the ecclesia. verse 4, whosoever therefore shall humble himself as a little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. Now you think of this. There's a little child in there. Unless you humble yourself, become like that. As he explained in Mark, that he that wants to be first should be last of all and servant of all. If you can think of the least brother or sister in the ecclesia and be servant of all, that's what I want, said the Lord. That's not elevating yourself. That's serving others. And he said in verse 5, if you receive a person like that, you receive me. He added in Mark, and if you receive me, you receive him that sent me. In other words, our relationships with each other are of extreme importance. When we wound each other, said Paul in Corinthians, we wound Christ. When we receive each other, we receive Christ and we receive God. And what that does, friends, is elevate our relationship in the ecclesia to an exceedingly high level. We're not just talking about fellowship between brethren and sisters. He that receiveth me receiveth God. So you see, now introduces a very, very careful way in which we need to treat each other. This is what Amos is talking about. Now you know, we can receive other people, but in verse 6 we can cause them to stumble. Whoso shall offend, and the Greek word scandalizer means to cause to stumble, to put something deliberately in their path, like the Nazarites in Amos chapter 2. Look at verse 6. Whoever shall cause to stumble one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hung about his neck, that he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Now think about that. If we have placed before another brother and sister something which has caused them to stumble and leave the truth, the Lord says it's better for you that someone just drowned you in the midst of the ocean than to face me at the judgment seat. And that's exactly what they're doing in Amos' day. By deliberately giving wine to the Nazarites who were committed not to have wine, they were causing people to stumble. The Lord said in verse 7, woe to the world because of stumbling blocks. I mean, the world puts many stumbling blocks. Business, pleasure, pride, evil, entertainment, you name it. Woe to the world because of offences. It must needs be that stumbling blocks come. The world is out there as an enormous trap. They will come. But woe to the man by whom a stumbling block comes. It were better for him to be drowned. You know, there are three powers mentioned in Scripture that were drowned with a millstone in the depths of the sea. Pharaoh's host drowned in the depths of the sea. Babylon, an angel took a stone and hurled it in the depth of the sea. And Babylon the Great, hurled in the depth of the sea with a great millstone around its chain. And all of those three powers have one single thing in common. They oppress the people of God. The Lord said, you do the same, as you'll join that crowd of people in their judgment, because you are no different to those people. And then he turns the whole spotlight onto themselves. You see, we may be in the truth. We may receive each other as brethren. We may not even cause others to stumble. But you see in verse 8, we can cause ourselves to stumble. Wherefore, if thy hand or thy foot cause thee to stumble, cut them off. We can be in a situation where I think all of us, brothers and sisters, have some type of, I guess, stumbling block that impedes our progress. I mean, don't you all feel like that? That there is something in your life that you know that it's going to cause you to stumble, and yet we feel that we can't get rid of it. It's just a little too nice to have around. Look, it's far better, said the Lord, that you discipline yourself and sacrifice yourself now than to be rejected, because that problem has caused you to stumble. Take heed, he said, over these things. The nation of Israel had gone out of their way to make others fall in the truth. Let's make sure, brothers and sisters, that we never fall into that category. That we never, ever cause others to stumble. And let's be aware also, brothers and sisters, that a far greater problem for us is if we cause ourselves to stumble. If thy hand or thy foot or thy eye or any part of your life causes you to stumble, then get rid of it. Because if you can get rid of it now, you won't be rejected at the judgment seat.